evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from jazz and blues bassist and vocalist Adriana Marie, revisiting a conversation from 2 years ago when she was set to perform at the Blue Jay Jazz Festival. She'll be there again this year, performing with the L.A. Jones Quartet at the upcoming Blue Jay Jazz Festival running August 22nd through the 24th. First, though, we have Lillian Vasquez with something that ties into this 50th anniversary of the moon landing and a lot of space-related programming around it.
Peter Jones has produced films for many years for A&E and PBS, among many other networks, on the topic of some of Hollywood's favorites, including Judy Garland, Beyond the Rainbow, Johnny Carson, King of Late Night, Stardust, The Betty Davis Story. But his newest project is part of PBS's Summer of Space project, which is programs airing across the nation commemorating the 50th year moon landing anniversary. His new miniseries is Blue Sky Metropolis. It's a 4-hour film and will air on our sister station, Empire KVCR-TV, on Thursdays at 8 p.m., beginning August 8th.
Thank you, Lillian. It's great to be here.
I'd like to first start with some of your earlier projects and then move to your newest project, Blue Sky Metropolis. In your early career, you worked within television news and then moved on to history of Hollywood's film industry. Why did you make that change? What stories did you want to tell?
Well, I'm a native of Southern California.
Nice.
And my grandfather actually came out here in 1919 from New York to make a movie. He was a silent film actor, and that's how my mother's side of the family got to California. And I went to graduate school in journalism and worked as a television reporter for about 4 years before moving back here to Southern California and starting my own company. I thought, what would people be interested in a, you know, not just for people here in Southern California? And I thought, okay, Hollywood entertainment, and especially classic Hollywood. So we would do a number of stories about the Hollywood sign, the stars on Hollywood Boulevard, and people just loved it. And it was nice to tell, you know, the factual truth, because a lot of times when you go on these tours, people just say all kinds of things and people buy it.
So after forming your own company, you went on to produce for A&E the series Biography, which I love. What did you learn about producing biographies and how to tell their story?
You know, I had a professor in college who taught a class called Biography, Autobiography, and History, and he taught me that through an individual life, that's a great way to tell the story, a bigger story of the world at large, how someone responds to events. Hmm. And through their life, you can plug into a bigger picture, and doing biographies allowed me to do that. And I just loved it, because a life gives you a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
It gives you a kind of a structure to work with.
And let's face it, all stories need a beginning, a middle, and an end, right?
They do, and life presents that. I've done famous, iconic figures, but I always approached it as, this is a human being. What were the things that influenced them that made them who they were?
You know, I have to tell you, many times when I'd be traveling, I didn't have A&E at my home for every reason, but when I was traveling, I'd be in hotels and I'd be watching 1 hour after another,
right,
until the wee hours of the morning. And I'm like, okay, I have to turn it off because I have to go to sleep. But I love biographies, and I love the many celebrities that you covered, as well as important figures. During this time producing for A&E, you did over some 85 profiles. Was there any one person or anyone's biography you didn't get a chance to tell that you would have liked to?
Oh, I can tell you. I had 3 holy grails in terms of biographical subjects. They were Frank Sinatra, Vin Scully, the voice of the Dodgers,
right,
for 67 years, and then Johnny Carson. And I managed to get Johnny Carson, which took a lot of time and effort. And Sinatra and Vin Scully, I came very, very close. But, you know, I go after subjects that are usually very averse to having any kind of, any more attention heaped on them than their private people. But being able to do Carson was a true a dream come true for me.
Yeah, I bet. And Vin Scully, still an opportunity?
Well, I went after him a few years ago. It was on my birthday. I had lunch with him at his country club where he plays golf, and it was the greatest 2 hours of my life. I mean, I grew up listening to Vin Scully as the voice of the Dodgers, and he was like a babysitter for me. And I mean, I just loved his voice, and to be able to just talk to him and get to know him. But, you know, at the last 11th hour, he pulled out. He's such a private guy and doesn't like to really talk about himself. He likes to talk about baseball, and he did that very, very well. At least I had I had a lunch I'll never forget.
Well, that's nice. I hope you document it in your own mind somehow, because if we don't get his story, and he does have such a big story here in Southern California, it would be a great story to capture, especially not just for Southern California, but nationally as well.
Well, Lillian, you said exactly what I say to convince a family or an estate or an individual to participate, because I said no matter how famous and prominent someone may have been, if there's not a record of who they really were,
exactly,
and all people will forget and they won't know except members of the family. And that's how I finally got Carson, was after 5 years after he died. I got the family to understand, you know, we really should do something, because so many of the people that Johnny interviewed and knew are still around, and they would be the best people who could attest to him, his character, and who he was as an entertainer. And that finally convinced them.
I'm speaking with film producer Peter Jones. His new project is Blue Sky Metropolis, coming to PBS stations this month. I want to ask you a little bit about Ozzie and Harriet, The Adventures of an American Favorite Family. I had the opportunity to interview Ricky's four children for a project here at our PBS station, which was wonderful. Were the Nelsons very different than the family they're portrayed on television?
This was one of my favorite documentaries to make, because with the Nelsons, at the time our documentary came out, the Truman Show came out, the film with Jim Carrey where he slowly realizes, wait, his whole life has been filmed, and he's like a character in this play of his own life. And the Nelson family was, a television family playing themselves, but then there were also the Nelsons in real life. And I found that there was an extraordinary thing that happened while we were shooting interviews. They would communicate almost through me in my interviews with one another. It was interesting that they were using the medium of television to talk to one another, family members that hadn't been close. And I became aware of that and thought, wow, this is totally fascinating. But the four kids of Rick and Kristen were terrific and very articulate. And I had a real affinity for Rick Nelson.
As did I.
He was very talented and very gifted. And his brother David told me, you know, everything came harder for David, and he had stomach problems, and he would lie on the floor and in the living room just to calm himself down. But he said, Rick, he was a natural, and, you know, read his lines perfectly, and he was a great performer, and he was so charismatic. Mm. And but you know what? Everybody suffers in their own way with something, and he was, a troubled guy and had depression, but he was a funny guy and a kind person. And people who knew him really loved him beyond just the teen idol heartthrob.
Right. I enjoyed interviewing all four children, and they were very frank, very open, obviously very knowledgeable about show business and their careers and their parents and their grandparents' careers. Yeah, it was quite interesting. All right, let's move on. For PBS, you did Goldwyn for American Masters, and that's kind of come full circle with Tony Goldwyn, who narrated your current project, Blue Sky Metropolis. How is the Goldwyn project, and share what it was?
That was a project where I was approached by a son of Samuel Goldwyn, Samuel Goldwyn Jr.
Right.
He had gone through three documentary filmmakers already by the time he got to me, and I was absolutely committed to making sure we got this done. And I made it in association with the great biographer A. Scott Burke, who wrote a biography simply called Goldwyn. And I wanted to tell a history of Hollywood through this life of truly probably the greatest independent producer Hollywood has ever had. And here's a guy who completely invented himself right down to his name. And he really, we could tell so many stories about the social world of Hollywood and the filmmaking process, because he hired a stable of people that always would work with him on all the projects. We really, I loved making that film, and I got to talk to a lot of people that are now, that have passed away and have a great record now because of those interviews.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You know, Leslie, I wanted to ask you, and we kind of touched on Johnny Carson, who I understood to be a very, very private person.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about the king of late night, which I feel he really was the king of late night, but that's probably based on my age. What did you learn about this Iowa-born, Nebraskan-raised comedian?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, why I wanted to do this so passionately, here was a guy who was watched, get this, 15 million people a night, Monday through Friday, for 90 minutes,
right,
would watch Johnny Carson. He was the most famous man in America, and he was still a very private, and who he was on stage really was that Midwesterner. There was a kind of he had a gentleness and a kindness, and he really listened to his interviews. Really a fantastic interviewer, and what people see are the sketches and the skits, but Johnny Carson was a great interviewer, and we were fortunate after we made the documentary about him, I was able to convince the family, let's pull 50 interviews from famous, fantastic movie stars and creators and show the public, you know, a 10 to 12 minute interview where Carson is just one-on-one with someone, and we were able to do 50 of those, and they aired on Turner Classic Movies and were very successful because Johnny did what he did best, which was listen and talk.
A little different than some of our late nights today that want to be funny, and that's okay, that's entertaining, but I prefer the ones that ask the questions that I'd want to ask, or that I learned something new about that artist that I didn't know before he or she sat down in that seat.
Absolutely, and you can tell that it wasn't now, and I know how it works because I interviewed all the late night hosts, and you know, they said, look, everyone with their handlers now, they need to know what questions will be asked, and they have to have two stories that they know that they're going to tell,
right,
and the questions that will be asked, so it's much more prefabricated and not as spontaneous. With Carson, I just watched one last week with Carl Sagan, and you could just see Johnny was prompted by what he had just heard, and it was genuine engagement with another human being, and the art of conversation was on display, and he really was special in that regard, and it's something that's lost now because we have attention deficit disorder as a society.
Thank goodness for PBS and NPR, where we can take the time to tell the stories.
Absolutely true. I completely agree.
That's Peter Jones in conversation with KVCR's Lillian Vasquez. Peter Jones is writer and director of Blue Sky Metropolis, airing Thursdays to 8 p.m. through August on KVCR-TV, focusing on the people behind the aerospace movement and featuring many of the current major players in the aerospace industry in California, the hub of modern-day aerospace engineering. We'll have more just ahead. Later in the program, Adriana Marie, performing with the L.A. Jones Quartet at the upcoming Blue Jay Jazz Festival, August 22nd through the 24th. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org.
So let me ask you, where were you when you watched Johnny Carson's last show? Do you remember?
Well, it was May 1992. I was at home. I was here in Southern California. And the show that I remember the most was the second to the last show, because that was the show where Bette Midler performed. And in my film, I
thought that was
that as the last moment where she is singing to Johnny. That's the second to the last show. The very last show, it was just Johnny and Ed and Doc, and they just showed clips from the 30-year run.
Oh.
But it was that second-to-last show where Bette Midler appeared and sang to Johnny. They did a camera angle where you never saw that on the show, where you could see Bette, and then the camera looked beyond Bette, and you could see Johnny just mesmerized and crying, listening to her.
Yeah.
It was so beautiful. So, yes, I vividly remember that episode, the second to the last show.
Well, that's good to know. I thought that was the last show, and I was at the Ontario Airport in a bar getting ready to, but I didn't want to miss it, and, you know, this was before cell phones, and I was watching it in a bar so I could see it. I didn't want to miss it. And I was crying at him tearing up with Bette singing, and I thought that was the last show. So thanks for letting me know that it was actually the second to the last show that I was most concerned with. It was just such a beautiful show.
Well, I used it anyway as the final moment in the film because it did encapsulate so much the love the performers had for him, the love he had for the audience. It worked beautifully.
Did you interview Jay Leno for that one?
Yes, in fact, this morning, I made my lavender tea in a Tonight Show starring Jay Leno cup that says guest number two on the back. Yes, I interviewed Jay. I interviewed David Letterman, Joan Rivers, Conan O'Brien, Arsenio Hall, Dick Cavett, any of the living talk show hosts, Ellen DeGeneres. Everybody said yes for Johnny. Everybody.
Joan Rivers said yes, even though they had their falling out.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. We had a great interview, and in the film, Joan acknowledges, really for the first time, I really should have told Johnny directly myself and first that she was going to have a show on Fox, this new network called Fox.
Right.
And she didn't, and it broke his heart. And she acknowledged that. After I sent her a copy of the film, she was very upset with me because she thought I had twisted her words, and she went back to being the Joan Rivers who said Johnny Carson blackballed me and ruined my career and my husband committed suicide because of Johnny Carson. She just went on a rant. But people, when they watch the show, are very touched by the fact that Joan did, at least on camera to me, acknowledge, you know, I should have told him myself. It shouldn't have gotten to him the way it did.
Well, thanks for saving all those stories and telling them. Let's talk about Blue Sky Metropolis. It's a 21st century story that looks at the past, the present, and the future of aerospace right here in Southern California. Looking at those featured in the film included John Northrop, Donald Douglas, Amelia Earhart, Howard Hughes. They all made sense to me. But Walt Disney, too, how did he fit into the mix?
Walt Disney, interesting. And that's a great question. Walt Disney shared his great strength was he knew how to allow people to create, and he created this department called the Imagineers, where he just allowed talented people to have free rein and come up with great ideas, and he would guide them. This is something that I found the pioneers of aviation had a similar creative spirit and a sense of, well, of course I can fly. Where other people would say, well, that's not possible. Walt Disney, and I found these pioneers, all shared a belief in themselves that they could make a dream come true. Just like the song, When You Wish Upon a Star, dreams really, and Over the Rainbow, where dreams really do come true. And Walt Disney had that. And the early pioneers, Donald Douglas, Jack Northrop, they all shared that, this sense of confidence, a quiet confidence, but an ability to make something happen that had never happened before.
What a concept to put imaginative people together to come up with more concepts.
I know, isn't it? And to call them the Imagineers. What a great name.
As a kid, were you watching the Jetsons, and was that your first inspiration to, you know, to space and telling this story that you've produced?
Well, growing up, my dad was an aerospace executive at Northrop Corporation, and so I grew up with a father who was working in the industry, but I was also growing up during that incredible period where, well, they call it the space race, where we were competing with the Russians who will get to the moon first, and it was so exciting. I remember in second grade and third grade when the teacher would roll out a television set, and we would watch Alan Shepard take, launch, and then John mm-hmm. Glenn. And this was something you actually really believed, we are going to go to the moon. Now, today, 50 years later, it almost sounds futuristic to kids, and this is what I love hearing when they watch that brilliant film, Apollo 11. They watch and they say, that was 50 years ago. That seems so futuristic that someone can go to the moon. So that sense of wonder is still present in this millennial generation that wasn't around to witness this incredible period of our history. Yeah, those are astronauts. And Life magazine, the cover, I'll never forget when Ed White did the first spacewalk as an American. You know, you had to wait till they got back and they could develop the film. It wasn't something where we're going live in HD from Gemini 4, and the film would be developed, and then it would be on the cover of Life magazine a couple of weeks later.
Right.
And to see him out there in space, the blackness of space, and then the beautiful blue and white cloud Earth, it was just absolutely breathtaking for a kid.
I'm speaking with film producer Peter Jones. His newest project is Blue Sky Metropolis, coming to PBS stations this month. There are four episodes. Tell me about the four episodes. It's Wings Aviation Takes Flight in Early Los Angeles, The Big Chill, The Space Odyssey, and then Back to the Future.
Yep. Well, you can see that I chose to name an episode after an actual feature film because Hollywood and aviation, aerospace, they really grew up simultaneously and together, and each shared, these were risk takers and entrepreneurs. They accepted failure as a key component to success. If they fell down, they just get right back up. They just kept at it until they defied gravity. And it was really like that. One of the guys I interviewed, who was the head of Hughes Aircraft for many years, Ken Richardson, knew Howard Hughes, and he told me how similar he found Elon Musk of SpaceX today, how similar he was to Howard Hughes in that sense that he had made his fortune, and he was now taking great risks doing what people said couldn't be done.
Right.
And Musk famously made the impossible happen with his company and the success SpaceX is finally enjoying after several years of him not doing so well. But he would pick himself back up and he would have the engineers go back to the drawing board. And now NASA is using SpaceX to launch satellites. So it's quite a story. So each episode deals with an era. The first one covers about 1910 to the end of World War II, and then The Big Chill is, of course, about the Cold War and the arms race with the Russians. Episode 3 of Space Odyssey is about the race to get to the moon,
right.
But we do it through the stories of a handful of engineers who worked on Project Apollo, and so you get it, like I was saying earlier, telling the story of a big event through the individual experience. That's what we do with Episode 3 with the engineers. Finally, Episode 4, Back to the Future. There was a huge downturn after the Cold War ended. Here in Southern California, 500,000 jobs were lost, and it was not a peace dividend for Southern California. But this industry came back through individuals who had made a lot of money in the tech world, and now they wanted to have their own space companies. And now it's the private sector that is leading the charge back into space. And then they're doing it here because Southern California still has the university, UCLA and Caltech, still is a very fertile area for space.
And I wonder if people don't often think of that they think of Houston or Florida as the big places.
Oh, yeah.
But Los Angeles played a huge part, which you discuss in Wings in the first episode. I guess I hadn't given it much thought, but when I started seeing the names and I watched a little bit of the first episode, that clearly made sense to me. I have to tell you, I was in Houston recently on the July 20th at an Astros game, and they just commemorated it so beautifully.
Wow.
It was awesome. Even their animation on the scoreboard was astronauts, and all the ball players, when their picture came up on the scoreboard, they were in astronaut suits. It was just delightful.
Okay.
And Neil Armstrong's son threw out the first pitch.
That is fantastic.
It really was cool. All right. Why was it important for you to produce this film? What do you want the viewers to take away?
Well, you're dealing with the cosmos. I was so afraid of this assignment in the sense that it's not an individual, it's an industry.
Yeah.
And it's an industry that's been around for about 120 years now. And how do you get a handle on an industry that is so technical and is so precise? And I had to keep reminding myself, Peter, remember, it's the story of human beings. So tell a human story in each installment, and don't get too lost in the details about, you know, jets versus airplanes and Saturn V's from, you know, other rockets. Just keep it to the human drama of these people that just did not take no for an answer and just didn't look at failure as anything but a stepping stone to success.
That's a lot to keep reminding yourself when you're dealing with such a big subject.
Sometimes I get lost in the weeds because it is such a sweeping story. You go from being able to fly, and now we have these probes that are now have left our solar system and are now out there in the Milky Way. I'm thinking of Voyager 1 and 2, and we're still in communication with these probes that were launched 40 years ago, and we're still getting signals through something called the Deep Space Network. It's remarkable. They're 15 billion miles away. It's unfathomable, and we're still getting signals from them.
It took decades to tell this story. How long did it take you to put this project together?
It felt like decades, but it was really just a year and a half. It was so intense. I interviewed 67 individuals and brought 3 people back for another interview, so that was a total of 70 interviews. It's a lot of material, and fortunately, you know, they've set up at the Huntington Great Aerospace Archive, and I'm going to give all the raw interviews to the Huntington, so scholars and historians can watch these people, these eyewitnesses, tell their story and share what knowledge, they have. And for someone in the future, maybe they can learn something that would trigger something that makes something fabulous happen.
So what's next on your list?
When you're doing iconic figures, I can't jinx it by talking about it.
Okay.
It's a figure that has never agreed to participate, so there's a clue that it's a living person.
Okay.
And it will once again involve Southern California in a big way.
Okay. So who will it be distributed through?
That would be PBS, perhaps American Masters.
Great. I'll be watching for it.
Who could make it happen elsewhere. So that's another clue.
Okay. Very good. Well, I wish you success with that. I hope that you get around to Vince Scully. I think that's a great story. But in the meantime, thanks so much for your time and for this project.
I appreciate it. Good chatting with you, Lillian. Take care.
That was Peter Jones in conversation with KVCR's Lillian Vasquez. Once again, Blue Sky Metropolis airing Thursdays at 8 p.m. through August on KVCR-TV. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. Up in just about a minute, bassist and vocalist Adriana Marie performing with the L.A. Jones Quartet at the upcoming Blue Jay Jazz Festival. More at bluejayjazz.org. Also, right around this time, 2 years ago, her CD, Kingdom of Swing, was a fairly recent release.
There was a place called Palomar. Could they dance, boy, and how? 40 cents for the Jackson Queen. Cut my rug at the Kingdom of Swing. Riffs and hot licks, a mile long. Cats jumping on.
So for Kingdom of Swing, then, as an album, 6 of the 14 tracks you wrote, you and or yes. your partner L.A. Jones, were there originals on the previous Double Crossing Blues?
You know, there were no originals. That was completely an album of covers, albeit chestnuts, you know, from that era of music, fairly unpopular covers with the exception of one or two. An interesting thing you might want to include is that the title track, Kingdom of Swing, I actually wrote in high school.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, I'll go right into it. No question at all about this one being the title track. In it, we have mentions of Duke Ellington, Basie, Benny Goodman, since he was the king of swing, and then introducing yourself at the end. I'm Adriana Marie.
I know. So, I name-checked myself. Yeah, it just sort of worked out. That part was an afterthought. But, yeah, it was a project my junior year in high school from my musical teacher, theater teacher, in high school, and we had been studying that era of music on and off for the last couple of years in school and had put on a couple of productions, and that year our assignment was to write an original tune based on how those artists that we had been studying, Duke and, you know, all those swing era greats, influenced us, or a tribute to them of sorts. So that was what I wrote, and it's been sitting around collecting dust till this record.
Really? You didn't break it out until this?
No.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I actually have quite a big library of unpublished early writings, so there'll be more.
Oh, good. Well, that's something to look forward to. That means there's fodder for new discs left and right, as long as they fit together.
There are.
With this one being an introduction to yourself at the tag at the end, this could easily be a typical opener when you're introducing the band, although for that matter, I guess it could be a great typical closer for the same reason. Do you have any tendency with this song? Do you like to burst out with this one?
You know what? This band, it's, you know, Adriana Marie, and on the record, her room full of all-stars, but when we're out performing it and her groove cutters, I'm so proud of my band. And they're such fine musicians that, you know, it's a lot like Duke and Basie in the sense that the musicians that make up the band are so celebrated. There really isn't a spotlight on any one person.
Right.
So we always start every set with an instrumental or two because I feel it's such a beautiful thing to showcase the band.
Absolutely.
First. And so we always do that. But for this tour, since this record has come out, we always start the first vocal number of the first set as Kingdom of Swing.
Wow.
So, yeah.
It felt like an opener.
It is.
But it wasn't written for that purpose. This was a high school thing.
Mm-mm.
Were there any parameters given to you as a junior in high school when you were doing this?
Yes and no. You have to realize my parents were in the music business and performers. And so I've been steeped in this since before I could even remember. So I just kind of grew up, my first conscious memories of our performing. So by the time I was a junior in high school, I had been studying voice for years and dance and acting, and I was doing summer stock theater.
Oh, yeah, so you'd already done summer stock by then.
I was getting influences from so many places and was already pretty far along in the process that my creative juices were flowing so heavily by that point that I didn't need a lot of parameters. They were fairly loose. Some of the projects that got turned in were more tried and simple. Mine, you know, was a little bit fancier.
Okay. Humbly stated. Nice.
Yeah.
Riffs and hot licks, a mile long. Cats jumping all night, still going strong. More fun than you. Now here's my story, my right to introduce my fellas, I must, they are the juice, bringing you a bit of history. I am Adriana Marie. Oh, at the Kingdom of Swing. Yes, at the Kingdom of Swing.
I read that a vocal coach at one point started sneaking into jazz and blues clubs for inspiration.
Yeah, same one who assigned me the assignment
same one.
I wrote Kingdom of Swing.
Oh,
she
cool.
was Fran. She was pretty crazy. Yeah, okay. I look back and I think, how did she not get arrested?
Yeah. Well, regarding some of those clubs, those dark and smoky clubs, that is something that I also want to know. If you recall, what was your first memory, if you can, about one of those clubs? And this could be about a performer you saw or even how you saw folks reacting to the performer. It could be that sort of thing.
It was a club in probably one of the worst parts of Bridgeport, Connecticut, you could imagine.
Of course.
Just an old bar, red vinyl, plastic booths in a long bar and a tiny little stage at one end. People smoking and drinking, it just reeked.
Hmm.
And drug dealers and the addicts, you know, on the streets.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
We parked kind of far away and walked in, me and Fran, my vocal coach. I will not give her a last name out of courtesy. I don't even know if she's still alive. And one other student who she had sort of taken under her wing, like me, who was just, you know, a sponge, really hungry to learn everything we could from her. And we went into this club, and there was a guy, black guy, older black guy, I'll never forget his hands, just playing his guitar. Kind of Delta-type blues with a little bit of soul mixed in. I remember him doing an Otis Redding song also. And I just, oh my gosh, I don't know, somehow I related to him, and I felt like, I'm like you. You know, I just got this sense like, oh my gosh, I could just so relate to him.
You had an old
soul. And I wondered about his story. You know, I've been told by a lot of people, oh, you have such an old soul.
Yeah.
I did. Yeah, I did, even as a kid.
Feels like it, yeah.
I wanted to hang out with people who were older than me. I was not afraid to talk to grown-ups and older people. And I just saw this guy and listened to him, and I was so taken with him. Couldn't believe it. And he was just some old drunk guy sitting on a stool with his guitar. Probably wasn't even very good. You know, I mean, analytically speaking, you know, I don't know.
But there's
but
presence.
But he sure
there,
moved me.
Let's go back to Kingdom of Swing. And on this disc, I never thought that I would see a fresh approach to After Hours, the Avery Parrish tune.
Yeah.
And here I did, at the final cut. And this was just incredible. I'm not sure what it was in the beginning that set it apart, but it sure does. Maybe it's the opening. Who was responsible for how this one came out?
My husband wrote the arrangement.
Okay,
LA. The arrangement. And it's sort of a melding of the Pee-wee Creighton version mixed with another version. I can't remember whose it was.
Buck Clayton, by chance?
Yes.
Hey, cool. Yes. That's my favorite.
Yeah. And he just has been listening and doing this song for so long. And, you know, it was like, there was no question we were going to do an instrumental on this album, like we did on the last one, especially with this great band, you know. And so he worked really hard coming up with an original arrangement for it. I'm glad you like it.
Oh, absolutely. Cool. Again, that's just more of a classic tune that I think a lot of people catch on to. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Adriana Marie, speaking about her release, Kingdom of Swing, among other things. Adriana Marie will be performing with the L.A. Jones Quartet at the upcoming Blue Jay Jazz Festival running August 22nd through the 24th. More on the festival at bluejayjazz.org. More on Adriana, her music, and quite a few upcoming area performances at adrianamariemusic.org. Other tunes on this disc, on Kingdom of Swing, talk to me about the selection process. I mean, as far as a well-known standard, you do include Mood Indigo, but the others...
It's my favorite jazz tune, my favorite Ellington tune ever written.
Yeah?
My mother used to sing it to me when I was a little girl.
Wow.
Yep. Love this one. Been hearing it my whole life. Yvonne's version, the lady who sang with the Ellington version. Have you heard hers? That Mood Indigo version?
Yes.
Yeah.
the other tunes on here, let's go right to this one. I can't remember if this was Count Basie's 1 o'clock jump or Harry James' 2 o'clock jump, but the story goes that, let's just say Basie's band was playing it. He was asked what it was called. He looked at his watch and said, well, 1 o'clock jump. So is this the case with your 3 a.m. blues by chance, or did I miss a lyric in there that would have explained
it? No, 3 a.m. blues is really a blues that I actually wrote at 3 o'clock in the morning.
No, it really
That's
is.
That's where the name came from.
It really is.
I wrote that tune in the winter that I first moved up to Lake Arrowhead. It's a blues, and I wrote it. Have you listened to that track?
Yeah. I've gone through it multiple times by now, yeah. And so that's why
I just wrote it in the middle of the night. It came to me, and I leapt out of bed, and I went in the other room, and my husband came in, and he goes, what's the matter? Are you okay? And I said, get out.
Oh, that's
get
another
out,
one.
Get out, I'm writing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Again, several originals on here. It's a really nice, seamless blend. If a person doesn't know better, they may not even realize what was written maybe just a couple of weeks ago or a year ago versus something that came to us from 1932 or something like that.
Yeah. But
I'm curious if there are any tunes recorded or maybe even about to be recorded that, let's say you just sing around the house and L.A. comes up and says, man, we got to record that. He just loves the textures that you throw into it, the flavor. Mm-hmm. Anything like that? Or was that Mood Indigo?
Since moving up here, which it'll be 3 years this November, we lovingly call our house, and it got the name quite quickly, Birdland.
Oh, okay.
So much so that we have a sign on our front door that says Birdland and has the original Birdland logo because L.A. is an absolute Charlie Parker fanatic.
Yeah.
And we both grew up on the East Coast. So anyway, it's kind of this double entendre because we live up in this little chalet up on this mountain. So anyway, but the point I'm bringing this up is that we play nearly every evening at Birdland. Mm. And we actually have a jam, I don't know, a couple of times a month where some of our local musicians and jazz friends come over and we play. So there's a lot of music. The apple didn't fall far from the tree.
Sweet.
You know, with my folks, we do this a lot. And we are already working on material and have been for about 4 or 5 months for the next record, which we're due to record early in the year.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because one thing I've learned, I know a lot of people, they do a record like Kingdom of Swing or whatever their particular Kingdom of Swing is, and they have all this creativity and stuff that goes into it, and then they feel like they have to get another record out, and they maybe grab stuff that really isn't stuff they really, really love to do or are super artistically and emotionally invested in. And to me, that comes across. I've heard some of my friends, and I've heard other records, and I'm like, you know, they're not invested in this song. I just get that sense. And I've been lucky that we've had songs and material that's been original and otherwise that we're all, particularly L.A. and I, super invested in.
That really, really comes through. Again, I'm only aware of these two discs, Kingdom of Swing and the previous Double Crossing Blues. I know that you listened to a lot of Basie, some early Basie with the Helen Hume stuff and all that.
She was a wonderful songwriter. Most people don't know that. You know, they just know the her that, you know, Basie discovered. But she was a great, great songwriter.
I did not know that, no.
Yes. And, you know, he controlled much of her career for a good portion of it. And she wrote a lot. Didn't always get to, you know, perform what she wrote. But, yeah, she was a prolific and wonderful songwriter. She really had, of all the female artists that have influenced me, she really had one foot in the jazz world and one foot in the blues realm.
Truly.
Deeply. Deep blues.
Truly.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
I'm happy that you're keeping it alive.
Quite so, yeah. Yeah.
You're really pouring your soul into both of these discs, and it's hard to classify it into jazz or blues. It really falls into an early Kansas City jazz, if I had to sell it somewhere, but, you know.
I agree. Yeah. That's a good, funny, we were just on tour a couple of months ago, and we went to the Jazz Museum in Kansas City, and I was...
Beautiful.
And, you know, we did a J. McShann tune on the first record.
Yes, you did.
We adapted it a little bit differently than he did because of the musicians in the project, particularly L.A., you know, they heard it a different way, so we didn't really give it the flavor, you know,
sure.
The Morphy
hands
band
off.
Hands off.
Yeah,
but that's a J. McShann tune.
Okay.
I love Julia Lee, and some of the early Kansas City artists are incredible.
Most certainly.
Yeah.
It's been music from and conversation with Adriana Marie to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Once again, Adriana will be performing with the L.A. Jones Quartet at the upcoming Blue Jay Jazz Festival, running August 22nd through the 24th. More at bluejayjazz.org. And more on Adriana, her music, and quite a few upcoming area performances at adrianamariemusic.org. Thanks again to Adriana Marie, as well as to Christopher Gross with the Blue Jay Jazz Society. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Sharina Wadd, Natalie Calmer, and KVCR Director of Operations, Tony Papa. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.